Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Shots Fired podcast. We are excited to be back in studio. We've been gone a lot, podcasting on the go. We have an awesome guest for you guys today in studio, and that is Melissa Freitas. Melissa, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me back, guys.
Absolutely. Again, for being on the show. Melissa was on the show early on when we first started the podcast, so we're excited to bring her back. We have a lot of excellent information to share with you guys. In fact, the number one question we get asked majority of the time is, you know, questions about post-trauma, EMDR therapy. And Melissa is a certified post-trauma therapist, and she's here to answer all of those questions for you guys. So if this is your first time watching on YouTube or listening to the podcast on audio, make sure you guys subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes, and welcome. So let's get started into the episode. So Melissa, thanks for being here again. Go ahead and introduce yourself to everybody. Give me a little bit about yourself and your bio and how you ended up here with us today.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for having me back. So my name is Melissa Freitas. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist, and I specialize in working with first responders, especially after critical incidents. So I got into this in kind of a roundabout way. I got into therapy and was just pursuing working with people with anxiety and depression, and at the time was married to law enforcement. And my husband was involved in a critical incident. And he never really got the treatment he needed. And I saw kind of the impact on our family and what it did. And so as I went further in my therapy journey, I started just specializing with this population. And I've spent a lot of time and energy doing my ride-alongs and making sure that I understand the culture and backing that with, you know, evidence-based trauma treatment, such as EMDR.
And how long have you been doing EMDR therapy?
Let's see, about 10 years now.
Nice.
So Mark and I have been traveling around the country teaching classes and speaking to a lot of cops all over the nation. And in the single-handedly, the number one question we get asked is, you know, when I ask people, hey, who here has heard of EMDR? You may get one or two people out of a class of 500 that will raise their hand that have ever heard of it, which, you know, to me is mind-boggling. When I went through my situation, I had never heard of it either. And I had to do my own research to find out what it even is. And EMDR therapy is a science-based post-trauma therapy. Can you explain to everybody what exactly EMDR therapy is and how it can benefit first responders and why it's such a high used, you know, type of therapy for, you know, cops, firefighters, nurses, and so on?
Definitely. So EMDR, first and foremost, kind of stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And in the name, it's kind of telling you a little bit about what it does. So we use eye movements and EMDR. Then we're desensitizing you to what your critical incident was. So the way that your body feels in reaction to your critical incident goes down. And then the reprocessing is traditionally when we have a critical incident, people say something about themselves afterwards. I'm a failure. I didn't do enough. I'm a disappointment. And so it helps reprocess those cognitions that people have. And the way that it works is that in the most simple, basic form is that when your brain is experiencing a traumatic event, the information gets put into like a trauma capsule within your brain. And let's just say that it's stuck on the left side. All the information that you have on the right side, maybe that's all the emotional adaptive information, is not getting wired into the critical incident that's stored over on the left, or vice versa. And so when we're doing EMDR, we're crossing the midline of the brain, and we're asking both the right side and the left side to communicate and tell what information it has. And so when we're doing that, the brain is actually reprocessing the information. It's going back through the critical incident. And then it's actually rewiring the brain so that the way that you remember the memory is now different. And so most of us know what REM sleep is. So it's rapid eye movement. And when we're in REM sleep, our eyes naturally just bounce back and forth. That's actually the brain science that EMDR is based off of. Francine Shapiro was the developer of it. And what she found is that when she had people move their eyes back and forth, that naturally they started to relax and calm down. And what they found was that when they're doing the EMDR work, because it's passing over the midline in the brain and it's getting restructured, the REM sleep allows the neurons to become more flexible and move, where traditionally they're just stuck and locked in the brain. And so the eye movement tells the brain to open up and allow the change to take place.
So I guess the question I have would be, would it take one critical incident for, let's say, a police officer to go through? And when we talk about critical incident, it doesn't have to be shootings, you know, baby deaths. It could be whatever's, you know, traumatic to that specific person, right? Something they've never experienced before.
Physically or emotionally overwhelming incidents.
What if it's not a certain instance? It's a cumulative of, you know, many little things.
Definitely. I mean, the biggest trend that we're seeing right now in working with law enforcement is actually trauma stacking. Mm-hmm. That's the number one thing that we're seeing is that people aren't coming in with just one incident. We're coming in with, you know, 3, 5, 10 years worth of critical incidents that are just compounded in the brain, not being processed.
So it's accumulative over time.
Right.
And why do you think that that is?
Well, when the brain doesn't understand something or it experiences something that it is very overwhelming, what it starts to do is it like dog ears that page in your brain or the amygdala says like, hey, remember this, it's really important. And then anytime you have another traumatic incident or overwhelming incident that's similar, the brain grabs it and locks it in there together. So even once you have one laid down, it kind of becomes like a sticky spot in the brain. And then the brain will start layering similar incidents on top of each other.
Hmm. So you could experience one incident or a cumulative.
Absolutely.
And how would I know that I need that type of therapy? Because I know, Kyle, you've shared a lot of stories about your success with it, but how do I know if I need it or somebody else needs that type of therapy?
Can you remember what you were doing 3 months ago on Saturday about 2 p.m.?
Absolutely not.
No.
Okay. If you can remember a critical incident that's more than 3 months ago and you can still see it, you can still hear it, you can still smell the irony of the blood, you can get a nasty flavor in your mouth or your body just kind of does that, you need help.
The
body
good.
Should not really remember the details of things after about 3 months. It naturally should start to come down. That natural feelings are like a fire and over time they turn into hot coals. With critical incidents, it was a fire and now it's an inferno. And there's something going on in the brain where it's heightened this. And so sometimes guys will come in and they'll say, you know, Mel, it's happening again, or it feels like it's happening again, but it feels worse. And that's actually correct. Once we've had a critical incident happen, when the body feels it again, like it's rehappening, it actually feels it at 4 times the strength.
And what do you think, what are some of those symptoms that you think some of the first responders are going to feel or, you know, sense that would trigger that? Mm-hmm. What are some of the symptoms of it?
So I brought that sheet for you guys to kind of look at to be able to understand it better. And when we have undischarged traumatic stress, the body gets stuck on. The nervous system is in a constant state of hypervigilance. And so a lot of guys will start to notice anxiety, panic, hypervigilance, inability to relax, that stuck on feeling where you can't really go to sleep. And then if you're not careful, it'll really turn into some hostility and rage. And that's when the nervous system is stuck on versus... If something stays hot for too long, we all have a default mechanism where it turns off. And what will happen if you've been in that stuck on position too long from a critical incident, you'll actually kind of get stuck off. And it's the exact opposite. The nervous system has shut down because it's been on too long. And then you're depressed, you're flat, you're lethargic, you have bad digestion, chronic pain, you're disconnected from people. Or, you know, we joke that at home you probably have a magic chair that you sit in and scroll on your phone and lose time.
Would you say that it would be normal, some of those symptoms that you just said, or some of those would be normal, you know, following a critical incident, but you're saying, you know, how long should it take for that, for those symptoms to kind of taper off to where, okay, maybe it's not a huge problem. Are we talking like a week, a month?
Mm-hmm. So traditionally you have about a month. Your body should be able to naturally process a traumatic event. You have about 30 days. But after about 30 days, really that 3 months, if it's still that way, yeah, then you're looking at more PTSD criteria.
I think that like gives me a ton of information that I wish I would have had a long time ago, because there's a lot of calls that I've been to, and I'm sure a lot of everyone has, where it sticks for a very long time. And if I would have just known that, I think I could have probably reached out for got some help earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, in this line of work, I mean, we experience so much, and obviously, you know, probably depending on where you work, but you're going to experience more.
Yeah.
But you know, there's things that you think back in your career that you're never going to forget. You know, and I think one of the main problems why a lot of, I think cops in our line of work are coming to you with all these problems that are just stacked on top of each other and it's accumulative is because of the stigma out there that, you know, guys have experienced this or gals have experienced this traumatic event and they're too embarrassed to go get help. Right. Because in our culture, it's expected that you kind of just move on from it and go back to work and forget that it ever happened, but it's impossible. Right. That's scientifically just impossible just to forget that something like that ever happened. So I think that's probably why I would say that's probably the number one reason why, you know, a lot of officers later in their career, probably closer to retirement, are trying to come in and seek help because they're at their wit's end, you know, to the point of, you know, some suicide is the number one cause of officers' death every single year. It leads the way every year, which is sad because there's a mechanism out there that, you know, potentially could save these people. And it always baffles me that, like I mentioned earlier, when I go and teach a class or, you know, we do some type of public speaking engagement and I ask people if they've ever heard of this type of treatment. And like I said, maybe one or two or a handful of people will raise their hand. And then it's like, you know, people are always curious, like, well, what is it? You know, it's just crazy to me that it's not more well known. I think it's becoming more well known probably within the last, I would say 5 years, you know, mental health and law enforcement and first responders is becoming a bigger deal. It's being more talked about. But can we go through and let's say someone comes to your office, right? Because maybe they're feeling this way and it's not tapering off and they're feeling like they should get help. And real quick, before I jump into how a lot of this treatment works, would it be beneficial for, let's say, a police officer that's been involved in a critical incident to come into your office immediately following the event? Or should they wait a certain period of time to see if some of these symptoms taper off?
Actually, most first responders do really well after critical incidents. The brain recovers fairly well if there's not a lot of barriers, such as alcohol on board. And so I really like to give guys the benefit of the doubt and say, go ahead and see what you look like 2-3 weeks out. And then after 2 or 3 weeks, if you're still having symptoms, then come on in. But I do trust the brain first.
Okay. So following a critical incident, you're saying, hey, give it a couple of weeks, see if any of these symptoms you're having subside. If not, then come in. Don't just, you're involved in a critical incident. All right, let's just immediately get you into EMDR therapy. Is that just because maybe there would be no need for it, or you want
to? Not every critical incident is necessarily going to cause PTSD. Law enforcement is involved in critical incidents every day. Me, my average lifetime, a civilian, we experience 2 in our lifetime. Cops, you guys are about 180 in your career. And so not every one of those is going to be traumatic, but there's going to be that handful that really just stick out. And we know that it usually has to do with other officers, family members, loved ones, and the big one is kids. Hmm. And so those are going to be the bigger ones.
Okay. So let's talk about some of the treatment that, you know, you guys as therapists who do this type of therapy, what is the average person going to experience when they go and do an EMDR therapy? Because it's not just a talk therapy, right? There is science base behind it. And can you kind of walk us through what some of the techniques are?
Yeah, definitely. So one of the things I want to say about EMDR of why we really like it for law enforcement is sometimes you guys don't want to tell the story. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's just too much or too much detail to go over. And so in EMDR, we don't actually necessarily require you to do a lot of talking. Most of the trauma processing is done in your head with visual images that is what you saw when the incident took place. So when guys are coming in, I want them to know that they don't need to feel like they're going to have to relive this experience and tell the therapist over and over again what the details were. So most guys come in and we have a protocol that we use. We come in, we're going to do your history. We're going to find out a little bit about you. We're going to make sure that you have some tools so that if you get, you know, tearful during the session or you kind of feel anxious, that you have some tools to calm yourself down. Once that's done, we're going to start to kind of lay out what the critical incident was and, you know, what is the impact on you? What's your kind of worst moment? What's it making you feel, think? And then we'll actually start the EMDR from there. And so when we're doing EMDR, we ask somebody, can you tell me the worst image or what was the worst part about that event? And then once we have the image, we'll start to kind of talk with them about that, the thing that they're saying to themselves. And we have that totally set up and we'll actually have them hold these paddles. And what the paddles do is, here, Kyle, I'll make you hold them. They just fit in your hand like this. And then the therapist is going to ask you to think about your critical incident. Traditionally, we'll have you close your eyes if needed. And then we'll turn them on.
Oh, no, I'm just kidding. Just teasing.
I thought that actually shocked
you. It should shock the shit out of you.
So what I'm feeling in my hand is vibration.
And both hands?
No, and it's only one at a time. So Correct. It's vibrating left, right, Correct. Left, right, one at a time.
That's right. So it's stimulating opposite sides of your brain. Left brain, right brain, left brain, and crossing over that midbrain and helping the amygdala start to calm down so that it can process that information. And so we have you hold these while we're going through it. Originally, when EMDR came out, what we thought was that it needed to be eye movements. And so this is traditionally what eye movements look like in the past, was a therapist would hold their fingers, we'd go, and then we'd go all the way. And if you could see Kyle's eyes, they're actually going all the way over, crossing the mid, and then coming all the way back. And what that's doing is it's forcing the brain to reprocess that information. And so when we started, that's why it's called EM for eye movements. But what we found is it really doesn't matter how we bilaterally stimulate the brain. It can be done with tappers. It can actually be done with music and headphones where you will hear a sound from each ear to the other ear. Sometimes we also will, you know, use your knees. You can actually do yourself as well. But as long as you have the bilateral stimulation while you're thinking about the critical incident, we can start to have it processed through.
And if I were to come into your office for the first time, up to that point, are we doing this the very first visit, or
so the first
jump
session
right into it?
So the first session is history taking. I need to know a little bit about you. I need to know your history. I need to know if there's any things of maybe why this wouldn't work. Maybe you have an eye injury, so I need to know that, you know, the eye movements aren't good, or maybe you've had some physical ailment where it's like, man, touching my legs really doesn't feel good and keeps me hijacked. So we're going to kind of do an assessment and a thorough history of, you know, what's your background? What have you been through? Because sometimes a lot of my guys come in and they don't think a critical incident was an incident until we get into it. And then through the history and assessment phase, we kind of realize like, no, there's some other stuff that's layered in there as well. So that's the first couple of sessions is the history. And then the next couple of sessions are just what we call resourcing, is making sure you have some tools to be able to regulate yourself if you need it. And then this is the big chunk of it. I have had, you know, success where in one session we get dramatic results. But for most people, you know, with a single incident, they're going to need a few sessions to process it, because the incident, you know, it's what did you hear, see, smell, taste, feel in your body? What are you saying to yourself? There can be a lot of information just in a critical incident that has to get processed.
And when you talk about measuring success, how do you measure success? And then maybe Kyle, you could say like what you felt is success, just because I don't know how to measure that. So yes. How do you measure success?
So we ask a question, which is how disturbing does it feel in your body? And I always tell my guys like, hey, this is a body-based question. I'm not saying when you think about that call, how awful does it, you know, feel in your brain? Because the brain will go, yeah, that was awful. But I'm asking you a body question because I can't give you amnesia, but I can take the intensity that you feel in your body, the pit in your stomach, that guilty feeling in your chest. I can desensitize you to that so that it's not really there anymore. So that, yeah, the incident sucks, but the way that I feel about it is okay.
Oh, interesting.
And for those out there that maybe have a couple of the symptoms, maybe they don't have all of these symptoms. I mean, at what point are you going to say, okay, is it one symptom that isn't subsiding that you should come in and get treatment? Is it two or three? I mean, how many symptoms? That's another question we get asked is, well, I don't have all of these symptoms, but I have, you know, the anxiety and the, you know, the hypersensitivity thing, you know, I mean, is there a certain number of symptoms that someone should be concerned about?
I don't think that there's a certain number of symptoms. Sometimes my guys just come in or girls come in and they just say, it's the intrusive image I want. I just want this to go away. I usually just ask the question of like, what's the cost of it? So I don't look at it in terms of symptoms. I look at it in terms of cost. One symptom might be costing you your marriage. One symptom might be costing you your career.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is.
And you had mentioned alcohol, you know, obviously compounding the problem. How does alcohol play effect into the whole thing?
Good question. Alcohol actually stops REM sleep. So when you're in REM sleep, that's naturally when your brain, like I said, is making memories, and that memory consolidation becomes flexible and we store information differently. And so when you're sleeping, you're preventing REM sleep. And so REM sleep is, you know, a great session of EMDR that your body is naturally helping you do. And when you drink even 1 ounce of alcohol, there is no REM sleep that will happen.
Wow. I did not know that. That's interesting. That's pretty interesting.
I'm embarrassed to say that I know what rapid eye movement or REM is, but I actually did not associate that with your eyes actually moving back and forth while you're sleeping. I had no idea that's what it did.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. Yeah. I don't know a lot, but you know, that's
I did not know
big
that
surprise.
Either.
I didn't know what REM was.
Well, you know what it is.
Yeah. I mean,
I just didn't really know what
it's good sleep
is.
Yeah. That's just, that's incredible that small amount of alcohol can disrupt the whole process.
So if you're an officer and you've been through traumatic incidents and you're going home and you think you need to have a beer or a mixed drink or something to calm down and go to sleep, you're saying that's probably not the greatest idea.
It's probably the worst idea. That I totally get it, right? The best way to feel like my nervous system has dropped back down is Jim, Jack, and Jose. But the truth is that they're going to stop REM sleep and they're going to stop your body from processing all of that information. And on the back end, they actually kick up anxiety. And then you have a pretty nasty cycle when that starts to go.
Wow.
Well, it's funny because usually, like, you know, if you're in an officer involved shooting and you end up, they send you home after everything's said and done, you know, they always say like, all right, don't drink any alcohol. That's the worst thing you can do. Right. But there's no follow-up as to like, why? So how many people do you think really, really pay attention to that? I mean, most people are probably going home and having a drink.
I did actually, when I was in my shooting, they said I should not do it because I was just really trying to listen, but.
Well, you're so good. You're funny. They said don't drink. So I was like, oh, I'm not going to drink.
Right, but nobody explained the why. So
yeah, that's true.
There's a why. Yeah, there's a why.
And it makes, I guess that's a huge takeaway.
Now, there's a difference between EMDR and brain spotting, correct?
Yep. So EMDR was originally created, like I said, kind of back in the 90s by Francine Shapiro. And then from her work, there was somebody named David Grand, and he was actually practicing EMDR. But he noticed when doing that eye movement that there was kind of that flicker that he would see in the eyes. And so he actually stopped, you know, and held that eye gaze when he noticed the flicker. And what he kind of found is that the eyes are actually connected in that certain position down lower into the brainstem. And so by keeping a fixed eye gaze, it drops the person down into their nervous system so that they can process the trauma on kind of a deeper, more somatic body-based level. And so brain spotting right now is going through like a lot of kind of vetting out and research so that it's coming up in the ranks with EMDR to show that it actually is a science-based research option. And so when we're doing brain spotting, we have a pointer like this, and we just ask the person to kind of think about what was going on and feel it in their body. And once we kind of see their body is ready, we start to move their eyes. And as they're doing it, we'll see a little bit of a flicker, or sometimes there's like a cascade that happens in the face. Or we'll get information from somebody that says like, oh yeah, why did I just have an image come up or felt anxious? And then the therapist just holds the wand like this and asks you to kind of keep a fixed gaze on the ball. And then in traditional brain spotting, we ask you to wear the headphones as well. So you're sitting kind of with the headphones on, silently processing the information. And brain spotting really helps kind of get down into the body so that there's not that physical feeling anymore when you think about the critical incident.
Huh.
That's pretty interesting. So when I went through the therapy with you and did the EMDR, you know, I hadn't even heard of brain spotting, and I actually just have been starting to hear about it. So it sounds like brain spotting is also kind of the up and coming with EMDR, but it's still being vetted out. Is it a treatment that's being offered to people though?
Yeah, absolutely. So brain spotting, definitely is a trauma-based treatment that is, you know, a great choice for our first responders.
But one's not better than the other.
No, I don't think it's one's better than the other. I think the difference is that sometimes I have my people that come in that really like EMDR. It's a little bit more structured. There's a little bit more talking and a relationship between you and the therapist. Mm-hmm. And then brain spotting, there's kind of more of this like quiet attunement where you're just kind of being with somebody in it, a little less talking. Mm-hmm. And each person's a little bit different. I really try to make sure that my client likes what we're doing. And sometimes it's brain spotting and sometimes it's EMDR.
Would someone that's trying to come in and seek this treatment, is there something that they could be doing that potentially could be holding them back from getting results from it? You know, meaning maybe not believing in the therapy or not taking it serious, or while the session is going on, not fully committing themselves, you know, to the therapy. Is that possible?
Definitely. There's some huge barriers when we're talking about doing EMDR and brain spotting. One is I can do all the magical trauma treatment in the world in session. And if you go home and drink, mm-hmm. now you just stopped REM sleep when you go home tonight. And so again, that memory consolidation that I was looking to change the way that your brain was structured, you just drank away our session. So if you drink after a session, it was completely worthless.
Wow.
The other thing that you can do is not be honest with the therapist. So maybe you're processing, you know, a kid call that was pretty traumatic, and you flash in your mind back to a kid incident when you were just a little kid, but you don't tell the therapist, you just stay quiet about it. Well, I can't really assess then what's going on. So not being honest with what's coming up in the session. And then if your home life is really, really chaotic, it's very difficult that I kind of relax the nervous system in session. I get it to relax, and then we send you back home, and maybe you have financial stressors and kids and wife, and there's this big conflict at home. It's really hard to kind of sometimes get some of that to stick. So we really want people to be in a place where they're not having, you know, bottom level Maslow's hierarchy of needs stressors mm-hmm. that are going to prevent them from really being able to focus and do this work.
Yeah, I mean, it makes total sense. You know, and when I first saw you, that was something that you had mentioned was, you know, getting kind of like my baseline of like, hey, what's my home life like? You know, how much do you drink? And you had actually made mention like you just flat out don't deal with, you know, people that would be considered alcoholics, mm-hmm. Which is huge in our profession, there's a lot of cops that are alcoholics. And it sounds like that is why, because really this level of therapy or style of therapy would be completely useless to you if you're consuming alcohol regularly. It's not even you're not even going to be able to help yourself.
Right. There are some clinicians, not me in particular, but there are some clinicians that actually just do EMDR and brain spotting just on addiction. But you'd want to do that addiction work before you do the trauma work.
I think you also have to, I don't want to say buy into it, but you have to be open to it. Because when I got mauled by that dog and it ultimately ended my career, I was seeing a psychologist, and out of nowhere, he just started doing the basic, what you're talking about with the eye stuff. And he asked me how I felt. And I was like, we started legitimately arguing. I told him he's wasting my time. And he never explained what he was doing and why and what the point of it was. And we did a whole session on it. And then I came back and he started again. And I was like, I'm done dealing with you. Like you're actually pissing me off because I don't know what you're doing. Mm. And then he realized that he never talked to me and explained the process. And then he did. And I was like, okay, but he kind of ruined it for me with that aspect. And then we ended up going a different route, which I think was helpful. But I guess, and I like the fact that you said that you really take the time to explain to people what the point of it is.
Right. If you take your car in to go get worked on, they kind of tell you, here's your estimate, here's your summary, here's what we're going to do. Do you want to do that or not?
Nope. I got a full rebuilt car. Here's the bill. I had no idea.
It's salvage title now, though.
Yeah, it was.
So yeah, we want to get consent from our clients. We want to give them the choice. Do you want to do this work? There's other choices out there, you know, like cognitive processing theory that allows you to do different work. But we want to educate our clients on this so that there is some level of buy-in. But most of my clients will say that they're skeptical. It's EMDR is lovingly referred to as kind of voodoo witchcraft shit. Just because it, like, why would that make sense that moving my fingers or holding paddles would do something? So people come in very skeptical, but once they feel the results, they do buy in.
That was, you know, I'll admit that I was skeptical of it when I first met you, because obviously I had never heard of this before. And so that was something that I remember you had said to me was, hey, you just got to trust me, buy into it. And you do have to allow yourself to, I think that is a good term, like buying into it. You do have to allow yourself to go there and let your mind and body go there. Otherwise, I feel like you're kind of blocking out the treatment, and then it's just not, I don't find it to be useful. But I did allow myself to buy into it, and I was skeptical at first. But then the more sessions we started doing, and I want to say I did a total of 16 sessions with you over probably four to five months. You know, and those were all for, you know, different critical incidents that I had been involved in. So it wasn't 16 sessions for one incident.
Right.
But you do have to allow yourself to buy into it. Otherwise, I just feel like it would be a complete waste of time. So that I feel like
that's why
a good word to use.
That's why I argued with the guy.
Yeah. So something else that we get asked a lot too is, and I've had, you know, officers come to me or email me or whatever and say, hey, I try to do EMDR therapy, and kind of like Mark's experience, they had a negative experience with it. And I've had some officers tell me that some of the therapists that they went and saw actually told them that they couldn't help them because their experience and the trauma or the critical incident they were involved in, it was kind of too much for the therapist to even hear. So let's talk about why it's important to, I don't know, maybe vet out the therapist that you're going to go see. What questions should first responders be asking EMDR therapists before signing up with them?
So one of the things you want to find out is what level of training do they have with EMDR? Obviously, we just have the basic level one, level two, and then we have certifications, and then we have some specialties. My biggest pet peeve is when somebody comes in my office and said that they, you know, finally reached out for help. They went to go see an EMDR therapist and they said, you know, I'm dealing with this critical incident with a dead baby. And the therapist goes, whoa, whoa, whoa. Mm-hmm. I can't hear about dead babies. I can't do that. And they walk out feeling like, oh, see, I knew this was too much for somebody. There's not going to be somebody to help me. So you need to make sure that you find a first responder therapist that is culturally competent. Somebody that has spent their time doing ride-alongs, field work, has, you know, either been maybe married into it or has lived that life themselves, but somebody that has a lot of cultural competency around first responders, so that you're not explaining yourself, that you know that person can actually handle the critical incidents that you're going to talk about, and making sure that they have treated first responders before. So ask the questions, how many first responders have you seen? Have you seen police? Have you seen fire? Do you do EMS? And can you tell me a little bit about your experience with that? I am lucky enough to get to work with some large agencies, and we actually get to go out in the field and do field work. And so making sure that a therapist has had those opportunities to actually go out and do their work.
It's interesting because I don't think the majority of people would even think to ask that. I think they would suspect, oh, well, they're an EMDR therapist, so they're by default, you know, prepared to help me. And that's just, that's not the case, obviously.
We talked about, and you asked her a couple of times, like success and the measurement and stuff. Can you actually see somebody progressing? Like, do you know, okay, they need help, I can help them, the process is actually working, and I think we could conclude for a while, like you're done, like you can go. Like, do you see that?
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, ultimately my goal is to get people back to work. So if there's something that's going on at work, maybe, you know, I've heard my guys come in and say something like, as soon as they flip on the siren, their body kind of lights up, and then they're driving to the call feeling really anxious and overwhelmed and like, am I going to be able to respond? And so I know treatment's working when we can flip on the lights in the patrol car and their body is no longer doing that and they're just ready to go back to work. Mm-hmm. And so we'll also start to see that people may not think EMDR is working at first, and they'll be like, I'm not really sure if it's working. And then they'll tell me something like, oh my goodness, I actually was able to go to Costco this weekend without losing my shit inside of Costco. And so they start to notice that kind of bad habits or patterns that they were doing pretty unconsciously, they stop doing, and they're able to drive down streets that they used to not be able to go, or they can drive past the house without the image of the child coming back up. And so I'll see them start to kind of reinvest in their life, reinvest in relationships or marriages or their careers, because they no longer need to kind of engage in the avoidance cycle.
And then how do you say, I think we're good for a while, or do they make that? Like, how do you know when you're done?
We set a treatment goal in the beginning. Like, what is it you want to have back? Like I said, I can't give you amnesia. There will be things that maybe for the rest of your life, you do not like the smell of fireworks. But now you're able to manage it and handle it when it comes up, even though you still don't like it. So we're going to pick that goal in the beginning of therapy. You're going to tell me what aren't you able to do that you want to do? And what's that going to look like? I want to actually be able to see an image in my mind of what you're going to look like when that happens. And then when you tell me you get there, we'll be ready for termination.
Do you ever find that you have people come in there that, you know, that are just basically checking the box, going like, okay, they're not buying into it necessarily. They're just like, oh, okay, we'll just see what this witch doctor has to give me. And, you know,
like you have to, because maybe,
yeah. And then they're not buying it. Yeah. The department's saying, oh, go see this person, or Kyle's saying, hey, go see this person. They're like, okay, I'll go give it a try. And then they don't buy into it.
Oh, absolutely. All the time.
People and then come you in just,
they're just not ready.
You just say, okay, well, come back when you're ready? Or do you say, like, are you sometimes able to like talk them through it to get them to trust you? Because I guess that's what it is. It's a trust, right?
Yeah. So sometimes I have to switch modalities. Maybe EMDR brain spotting isn't the best choice. Maybe we need to do some other stuff to stabilize them first. But then ultimately, yeah, the relationship between me and my client is what matters most. And we do know that that's an evidence-based statement, that the research does show that the relationship between you and your clinician is a predictor of the outcome of therapy. That if you don't trust somebody to work on your car, you don't go to them. If right. you don't trust me, you're not going to let me work on your brain.
Right.
And so you have to have fundamental trust for your therapist.
And coming into it, if you don't trust the process, or think that, you know, like you have the thought that it's, you know, voodoo stuff, like you mentioned, then you're going to come into it and it's not going to work.
It's going to be slower.
Yeah. Okay.
It's going to be slower. Yeah.
Okay.
But it is safe to say that what you're saying is that your symptoms are never going to be 100% just, you know, deleted out of your memory banks, and you're never going to have any, you know, sort of symptom from whatever critical incident you're involved in. You're saying that some, you know, it's there. It's just, you're able to, your body or your brain is able to manage it better.
I can't live my life if something is bothering me at 100%.
Right.
It's going to debilitate me, but I could probably live my life if something is bothering me at 20%.
Got it. Okay.
And so if you come in and it's like, this one thing is really causing me, you know, a huge detriment in my life, but then I can reduce that down to only about a 20% deficit, you're going to be able to go back to a lot more behaviors than you were.
Yeah. Cause we just don't, I think the idea would be, you know, you don't want people to think like, okay, I'm going to come do this type of therapy, and then, you know, at the conclusion of it, you're 100% cured, because that's just obviously not practical. It's just being able to manage whatever it is that you're having issues with.
Some people
at a comfortable level.
Yeah. Some people do get 100% better. But most people are going to have some little bit of something left over, whether that, you know, is, you know, a anxiety around something, or just they don't like the smell of it. There's probably going to be a little bit of something left, but it should be so manageable that you use a tool or a coping skill to deal with it, and you can go on with life.
Yeah, I remember mine being sound, mm-hmm. like the you know, unexpected loud noise is something that I was unable to, you know, completely mitigate or get rid of from doing the treatment. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously just something that I live with, but I am able to manage it.
Is it still that way?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. You've never seen him flinch?
I have. I get made fun of when it happens.
It's not like a full on flinch, but it's like a.
Yeah, but you're managing it. Yeah. You're not wetting yourself.
Yeah,
anymore,
I can manage like it
anymore. Yeah, I mean, yeah.
But you know, I didn't crap your pants this time. Yeah, no, I didn't do that. But I do think it's important for people to understand too that, like, if you are going to sign up to do this therapy, that, you know, don't expect, you know, just, you know, to be completely deleted and then, you know, your memory banks are completely wiped of whatever, you know, you experience. That's just, I want people to understand that it's just, it's managing it and being able to be more comfortable with it. So who would be a candidate for somebody that's listening to this right now? And I'm sure there's a lot of people that are racking things in their brain going like, oh, I've experienced this. And, you know, I'm feeling a lot of what you're describing. Who's going to be a candidate that should say, hey, I think I need to go and get signed up doing either brain spotting or EMDR therapy or, you know, and or both?
So I think somebody that is motivated for treatment, somebody that has insight and awareness, somebody that is actually not an over intellectualizer. So we notice that people who try to do EMDR sometimes can struggle a little bit more if they're super highly logical, and they can't seem to, you know, kind of just go with the process or see the images in their mind. They just like to think. It can be a little bit harder. If you're somebody who finds that, you know, everything else in your life is pretty calm or it's doing well, but this critical incident still keeps coming up, you know, you're definitely a good candidate for it.
Okay. Well, I think there's a lot of people listening to this right now that are contemplating it, and probably a lot of people out there probably had never even heard of what we're talking about. So I'm hoping that some of the listeners, or if you're watching this on YouTube right now, that, you know, really digest what Melissa is saying. And you know, if it's something that you need to do, then go take it upon yourself to go do it. Do some research, you know, on some therapists in your area. And speaking of that, where can people find certain EMDR therapists in the area that they're in?
Well, my hope is that departments are vetting out clinicians, that, you know, police departments and fire departments should be kind of taking the front on this and actually reaching out to the therapists in their community. And I would hope that departments have a vetted list. But I don't know that that's realistic everywhere here in the United States.
I don't think that's happening.
And so, what I would want people to know is that they can go to places like, EMDRIA, which is just the EMDRIA.com. And on there, they'll find by their state, a list of clinicians that are actually trained or certified in EMDR, and then they can actually narrow them down by specialty, what they focus in. And there's a lot of people on there that actually do show first responders and military as a specialty.
Huh. Well, we talk about EMDR a lot. I think cops could easily remember that because IA is in law enforcement. So EMDRIA.com. I think Everyone can remember that. It'd be pretty easy.
Yeah. And we'll put the link in the description of the video and on audio as well. But that's huge because we just had somebody reach out to us and ask us where in their area can they find an EMDR therapist? Right. And like, there's your answer right there. It's online.
I also think that, you know, you brought up like, if you're thinking that maybe you should be looking into something like this, you probably should be looking into something. Yeah. If there's any thought that, hey, you need, maybe it's not EMDR, maybe it's something else, but, yeah, if you're thinking about it, then there's probably a need for it.
And you can go through that website. Like if I didn't want my work to know, I could go through that website and I can do that off to the side and my work wouldn't even need to know.
Absolutely.
Okay. Cause I think that's a
signal. And there's a lot of departments and there's a lot of stuff where there's, you know, the department pays for it.
Yeah.
But they don't know who it's for.
Yeah.
I know my department has some option like that where you go to a therapist and therefore, cause a lot of people don't want their department to know that they have some sort of mental thing, which most cops do anyway, so it's kind of stupid, but <That's true. laughs> you know, like you're getting help that should be rewarded.
Yeah.
And some people think that it won't be, so they want it anonymous, and a lot of departments offer things like that.
Yeah, and I say check out your city if they have EAP. I went through the EAP program, and which you accepted, but I think obviously you need to ask the therapist, right, if they accept EAP, because then it's at no cost to the employee. It's something that the city covers and it's still confidential.
Right. And insurance covers this as well.
Yeah. So So there are ways around, right? There, you're still able to do this confidential if you don't want people to know about it. But if someone wants to go that route, is this something that, you know, people can do while still working?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. I would hope that guys are considering doing this earlier in their career, because we don't want to see trauma stacking. You know, we all have different analogies, but you get one trauma trash can or you get a backpack. And then once you've filled up your backpack, that's it. Your nervous system can only take so much before it kind of starts to decompensate and break down. And so if you get these out earlier and sooner in your career, you're going to have a longer career. Versus right now, the biggest group coming back to therapy is the retired guys, because they have 20, 30 years of this stuff compounded in there. And once, after about 3 months, it goes from short-term memory over into long-term memory. And, you know, it takes more effort to get it out of long-term. So if we come in sooner after the event, if the symptoms aren't going away, we can get those symptoms to go down quite a bit versus waiting 20, 30 years.
Some of the stuff we talk about in here is spousal support for the spouses of law enforcement. Do you offer, or is there therapy of EMDR for spouses, or do you see that there's a need for that because of their spouses?
Yeah. So spouses is kind of the second highest growing need right now, that spouses are starting to raise their hand as well and say, you know, wait, I kind of have this like vicarious PTSD after experiencing, you know, something with my loved one. Now I'm on edge and I'm hypervigilant and I'm anxious around them and I'm angry at them for what I just went through. And so wives absolutely, and husbands need to get their work after their person has recovered too, to help and support them with recovery. And so making sure that, you know, you have a clinician that has helped wives and spouses kind of recover from the aftermath of PTSD in your home.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because there's obviously a ripple effect.
You're a hero for heroes. You're like the SWAT team for normal police. Like when they need help, that's where they go. Yeah,
no doubt. I think it's a lot of good.
Of course, a SWAT guy would say that. Well, you're the SWAT team for police.
Help, they call a SWAT team. So when cops need help, they call you.
I think they call K-9 actually.
Well, they just kind of trail along.
Anyways,
or the fire department we call too. I mean, like for all the,
we all need our heroes, and fire guys are not.
SWAT's not my hero. Sorry.
Hey, listen, it's super good information, guys. And look, honestly, if you're listening to this and like Billy said it, if you're even thinking about it, or you think that, you know, it might be something you're interested in, I would say just go for it, right? Give it a shot. Look on emdra.com, see if there's a clinician near you. And get signed up for this, because you're only benefiting yourself. You're prolonging your career, your health, everything. You know, I have used EMDR therapy with Melissa. That's how I met her. And I can tell you honestly, for me, it helped tremendously. I truly think actually it saved my career. You know, I was ready to quit, throw in the towel, and I'm glad that I was able to do my own research. But, you know, I feel like cops shouldn't have to do their own research to figure out what's going on with them. It needs to be put out there. And that's why we're doing this podcast. That's why we have you in here, and we're pushing this information out to anybody and everybody that's willing to listen to it. You know, it is a process for post-trauma that really does help. You know, I can honestly say that. So thank you for coming in here and breaking this down and explaining it.
I just appreciate your time to come in here and explain all that. I've learned a ton of stuff, a lot of things I wish I would have known long ago.
Yeah. Thank I think you. One thing that I'll just add is that if you decide to come in and try this, there's not going to be any negative outcome from doing this. That you're not going to have, you know, your eyeball fall out or some new symptom that's going to be worse. So like the worst thing that usually happens for people is, you know, maybe a little bit of messed up dreams, headache, kind of tired, lethargic afterwards. But the cost of trying this with a negative side effect is pretty low and minimal. And so, you know, come in, give it a try, and hopefully get some relief, even if it's something you've been holding on to for 20 or 30 years.
Yeah. So it's definitely not going to compound the problem.
Right.
Well, this has been amazing. And I think if you have questions, leave them in the comment section or hit us up at shotsfiredpodcast.org and we will refer them.
Yeah.
And we'll definitely have to have you back, because I know we're going to get hit with a lot of questions.
Yeah, we are. And if we do get hit with questions, and guys, if we don't have the answer immediately, we'll, you know, we can always reach out to Melissa, get the answer, and then, you know, respond back to you. So be patient with that. But again, thanks, Melissa, for coming in here. We appreciate it. And hopefully you guys got something out of it. We will see you guys on the next episode. So thank you for tuning in.
Thank you.
See ya.